Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. We're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we talk with IRS Records co-founder and band manager Miles Copeland about his memoir and working with bands like REM, The Police, and The Go-Go's. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. But first, some new music to review from Brandi Carlile and Parquet Courts.
That is a little bit of Right on Time from the new Brandi Carlile album, In These Silent Days, her seventh studio album since 2005. An artist who began her career in the Seattle music clubs in the 2000s, working with twin brothers Tim and Phil Hensroth. They have been her collaborators ever since. They've been working together for a couple of decades now. She really had a breakthrough in 2018 with By the Way, I Forgive You. Everybody kind of points to that performance at the Grammy Awards a year later as kind of a signature moment for her national breakout. You know, people are recognized, this is a major, major talent.
And she got an armful of those golden statuettes.
She did indeed. And she soon went on to work with The High Women, an album that we reviewed, mm-hmm. an all-star contingent of country-tinged, Americana-esque performers collaborating. She did a cover of Joni Mitchell's Blue at a major concert event, tribute to Joni. She's written a memoir that was well-reviewed, and as I mentioned, that performance of The Joke in 2019 at the Grammys. So just a bunch of amazing stuff that's happening to Carlile now, being recognized as one of the great voices in Americana. So now we have this new album, In These Silent Days. Here's a track from it. It's called Broken Horses on Sound Opinions. Spaces and fields that lead for miles, Friday. Broken Horses by Brandi Carlile, In These Silent Days, her new album, her seventh. Mr. Kot, only broken horses know to run. Mm-hmm. This album gives me hives.
As you know, I have a severe allergic reaction to too much Broadway in any of my popular music, and especially in my Americana or my rock and roll. You know, she grew up as a Elton John fan, mm-hmm. and boy, can you hear that. Yeah. There is, you know, what do I mean by too much Broadway? I hate that inauthentic, super theatrical, singing over the top with a little bit of that diva kind of thing. Look yeah. at me, I can go to the Mariah Carey register. And wow, it just makes everything sound trivial. And that would be especially problematic if there were deep thoughts on this album, as there are in, I've read passages. I have not read her entire memoir, Broken Horses, but I've read passages from it. You know, and I'm sorry, I'm a tried and weathered woman, but I won't be tried again. That Broken Horses line I quoted, I want to be your silver bullet in your gun, she sings in a werewolf mama song. Mm-hmm.
My own sweet child, won't you promise me you'll be the one? My silver bullet in the gun.
Wow, I just, every time I listened to this album, I liked it less.
Mm. Well, I, you know, I hate to say I agree with you, but I agree with you.
Wow, I was expecting a defense.
I love Brandi Carlile. I think she's got a tremendous voice. And I picked that song, Broken Horses, to play because I thought it was kind of something more akin to what I was aiming for or hoping that she would be aiming for on this record. Like a very raw, kind of stripped down, you know, approach. You know, there's biblical imagery there and everything, but the grit in her voice really matches you know, the content.
Well, and everybody's talking about the rock approach on that song. I've read several reviews. I always listen a half a dozen times and then see what other people are saying and then listen half a dozen more. People keep comparing that to The Who.
Yeah.
I don't hear that. I hear the same problem we have in mainstream Nashville country, which is let's put a little Eagles in our country and we call it rock.
Yeah, although that wreck's harder than most Eagles songs, I'll have to say. And you're right about the Elton stuff. Paul Buckmaster, before he passed, did the strings on the last record. They had that big orchestral approach. They dialed back a little bit on that on this record. You know, she's working with Dave Cobb, who's one of the big Nashville producers. He's kind of the cool guy in Nashville, right, for the country artists. And they pulled back just a touch on that big orchestration, which was a good move. But the melodrama, man, it gets, you know, after a while, it just gets a little wearying. It's like how many bromides, how many bumper sticker choruses, how many kind of big cliche self-help, I'm going to, you know, get out from under this
you're talking
sentiments
about...
can you make in one record?
Stay gentle, keep the eyes of a child, don't harden your heart or your hand.
And I'm going, this is not profound. This is just, this is cliche, and she's smarter than that. I just think she knows, she should know better.
And we should point out she comes from an alternative perspective.
Oh, my God. John Perella said in a Sue comment, if there's a more classic 21st century figure than Brandi Carlile, who is it? Because she just seems to press all the right buttons. And the voice is there, the team around her is there, and yet we have this big, overdone, you know, Broadway-esque kind of record, and it's disappointing.
Much was made of the fact that it was made in isolation in northern Washington State, where she lives in a fairly rural area. Yeah. Her neighbors are those brothers, so maybe they just needed some outside ears.
I guess.
That is a little bit of a song called Plant Life from the seventh album by Parquet Courts, Sympathy for Life. Greg, one of the most spectacular live events Sound Opinions ever did was a concert interview double feature with Parquet Courts and Savages. Boy, was that a good night. Back when, you know, such things could happen in person. Who was this band? We caught on to them early on, right after their first cassette-only release back in 2011. A Texas group, quartet, that relocated to New York, really began to get a lot of buzz with Light Up Gold in 2012. Now they are on their seventh album. I'm surprised that they're around this long. We haven't heard from them since 2018. What is going on? You know, during the period just before COVID, apparently they started having a bunch of dance parties. Ooh, and listening quite a bit to Remain in Light by the Talking Heads. How does that result in the 11 tracks on this new album? Let's play one. We'll come back and give our opinions. This is a song called Walking at a Downtown Pace by Parquet Courts. The new album is Sympathy for Life. That I've tasted on the streets that I consume. Return the smile on an unmasked friend as we take streets. I don't walk down because I want to avoid finding temptation. Walk at a downtown pace and treasure the crowds that once made me act so annoyed. Sometimes I wonder.
Is Walking at a Downtown Pace from the new Parquet Courts record, Sympathy for Life. A lot of times, I think the focus on this band has been on the two main singers and songwriters, A. Savage and Austin Brown. Justifiably, I mean, they're a good team. They remind me a little bit of that Bob Mould, Grant Hart dynamic in the 80s. I think, for my money, as good as any band of the last 10 years in terms of just consistently good records. And what I love about them is that they never give you the same record twice. They're always evolving. This record is a great example of that. I don't think a lot of people are expecting a dance record from Parquet Courts at this point, but that's what they gave us. You know, they talked about, we didn't want to just do a band thing. Like, so, you know, I hear some reference points like the Happy Mondays, Stone Roses, that sort of late 80s, early 90s era of British rock where it was, you know, very much inspired by rave culture. But they were talking about, like, we wanted to be like a DJ, you know, the tones here were going to be a DJ related as opposed to band related. And Austin Brown did a lot of manipulating with, you know, the faders, you know, kind of a lot of a dub type of approach to the production. The stars of the show are, for the most part, the rhythm section. Great job by Max Savage on drums, A. Savage's brother, and Sean Eaton, especially the bass player. I think dominates
it's a bass heavy record. Yeah,
it is. And you know, Walking at a Downtown Pace, I love that song. Those that kind of marching drum vibe, very very political in spots. You know, the song Marathon of Anger really was inspired by the Black Lives Matter protests in New York City last summer.
A marathon of anger now. It's fun.
A couple of outliers, you know, they've got the Black Widow Spider song and the Homo Sapiens song, which are references to the punk aggression of their early days, but primarily a dance-oriented record. I think it gets a little soft in the middle.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ambient, jammy stuff that doesn't really go anywhere. The song-oriented approach that I love so much about this band sort of got tossed out the window. This band, I think this record primarily is going to be a vehicle for the live thing that the band does, and we'll see where it goes there. You know, I hate to make this comparison, but I will. You know, it's kind of like Fish. You know, see it live. It's going to be it's going to be better. It's going to be better live. You know, because the song, you know, it takes a while for some of the songs to gel. I think Parquet Courts has made about half of a good record here. I think there's dead spots here that I think are not quite as strong as the consistent records that they have been putting out lately. The last three or four records have been great. I think this is merely an okay Parquet Courts record.
Yeah, I would agree. I was bored by large stretches of it. Black Widow Spider, Homo Sapien, those are Parquet Courts by numbers, right?
Yeah.
If you had a Parquet Courts tribute band, you would play those, and they sound like everything else in the set. I advocated bumping in with Plant Life. You seem surprised. I just love the idea of a lyric imagining yourself to be a house plant.
Yeah.
So both of these seventh albums, Brandi Carlile and Parquet Courts, both of them quite obviously crafted in COVID isolation with just the core members. We were all kind of houseplants for a year and a half there. But, you know, that struck me as the rare lyric that jumps out. These guys suffer from pavement disease. What the heck? Our Parquet Courts talking about application, soothing like a mother's voice, speaks instructions to me in my native tongue.
Mm.
Is that a love song to Siri Amazon's Alexa?
I think there is some, deeper level stuff there that we'll never be able to fathom.
Although, think it's deep. I think it's stoner babbling.
Well, they got compared to Pavement a lot early on, right?
Yeah.
And I think they sort of evolved beyond that. But I will say that Pulcinella, the last track on the record, that gets me. It's personal. It's emotional. I think A. Savage has been writing some very personal songs amid all this kind of, collegiate level, wordplay on a lot of their records. He seems to have this knack for pulling out one track and album that just really nails
it. I'm bored by Parquet Courts. You say maybe it'd come to life.
I'm going to dance to
and
this
maybe
record.
It would, but I can't wait
to see him live.
I'm so bored by them that I'm not going to bother to see them live. You just tell me if they pulled that off.
That's what we thought of Parquet Courts and Brandi Carlile. Very mixed reviews. Records we were looking forward to, we weren't overly blown away.
In case people thought we got soft during COVID.
Well, we don't want people to think that. But we want to know what you think now. Give us a call. Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your opinion. Coming up, we have a conversation with music executive Miles Copeland. That's next on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. We recently caught up with Miles Copeland, the former manager of new wave legends, The Police, and the co-founder of IRS Records. The Police, of course, included his brother Stuart on drums, but that didn't limit his musical interests. He worked with an incredibly diverse range of artists, and IRS was one of the most important labels, certainly in my life. What about you, Greg?
No kidding, Jim. Hugely important. And Miles did work with a pretty good array of artists. The Go-Go's, REM, the Bangles, Dead Kennedys, that ain't bad.
Yeah, and many more. Miles Copeland took the time to sit down with us and talk about his new book, an amusing memoir called Two Steps Forward, One Step Back. Let's hear what he had to say and what it took to work with bands like those. Miles, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Well, I'm glad to be on it.
I know, for most people, the world shut down for a year and a half. Starting in March 2020, you said, okay, I guess I got to stay still for a bit. It's time for me to write down my stories.
For so many years, I've had people saying, yeah, you got to write a book. So when the lockdown happened, I sort of said, well, I have nothing else to do. So I started writing. About, 3 months goes by, and before I knew it, I'd written this book. What had interested me most was the lessons learned from both the successes and the mistakes. So I was more interested in a promotional, marketing stroke motivational book than I was about this is my life and this is what I did and aren't I great? That that always smelled of a little bit too self-serving to me.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, when I wrote, I figured, well, okay, I've got to mention my father in the CIA and growing up in Lebanon, and people will expect that. And so I threw that in as well, you know. But but basically, the reason the title is Two Steps Forward, One Step Back, it's sort of a recognition of the fact that no matter how smart you are and how successful you are, you're going to make mistakes. So you're going to have some two steps forward, but definitely you're going to have some steps back as well.
Well, there is an unusual frankness for music industry books. You know, Greg and I done this for so many years. We've read them all. You know, you own up to a lot of mistakes, you know, and also to happy accidents, things that you didn't think would work that did, things that you thought would work that didn't. There's an unusual frankness there. And were you hesitant in sharing any of that stuff, or you figured if I'm going to do this, I'm just going to lay it all out?
You know, I'd read so many books. A lot of people got things wrong, you know,
yeah,
or they misinterpreted, or they left things out so that you sort of came to a conclusion that was inaccurate. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do a book, I should make it as honest as possible. Truth is really this, is that I learned as much from a mistake as I did from a success. Sometimes maybe more so.
Hmm.
I think it's wrong for somebody to come out and just think that somehow they were always successful. You know, I wasn't. You know, I made mistakes. I missed some things, misinterpreted. But I think that's all part of the game, really.
The thing that's fascinating to me, Miles, reading your book, is that it reinforced the idea that you were sort of self-made. This was not an intentional career bent on world conquest. It was not like you had this master plan. It seemed like one thing after another sort of fell into place. You took advantage of opportunities when they presented themselves, but you weren't like, hey, I'm going to do this in 5 years. I really sensed that this was sort of a serendipitous kind of series of occurrences, including bankruptcy, which probably would have made most people fold up their tent just as you were getting going. What was it about this? And let's just be frank here. You know, the Hunter S. Thompson quote, the music industry is a cesspool, et cetera.
Rabid weasels.
You know, yes. Rabid weasels running amok. You wanted to stick it out in this business. What made you want to stick it out through the hardships and through the accidents?
Well, you know, I would probably use a baseball analogy. When you get up at bat, the first job is to get the first base. When you get the first base, your next job is to get the second base.
Yeah.
And then the third, and then the home. But if you get up to bat and every time you think, well, I'm going to get home, you know, without thinking, well, my first job is to get to first base, I think really you make a mistake. So you're right. I kind of did go step by step. I mean, I would go do one thing and that would lead to another and lead to another. And then maybe a tangent would happen and you go off in another direction. So I think really my father actually described it very well, the sort of flexibility. You know, if you don't know where you're going, you kind of go one step forward and then you see where the next one leads. And that's sort of where I went, really. I did not have a master plan. When I went to college and did an MA degree, I thought maybe I would do some sort of business in the Middle East, but you know, I kind of fell into the music business. That was not any idea other than the fact that I liked music.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about the idea that initially you thought you might follow in your father's footsteps and join the CIA, you know. It's like, hey, it seems like he's having a good time, you know, why can't I? And then you went into this really kind of still, everybody was figuring it out, business. What was exciting about it for you right from the outset?
Well, you know, my first experience was really going to London. And at the time, you know, the Beatles had happened and everybody was talking about things that are happening in England. But I arrived in a country where in a lot of ways it was pretty backward, you know, and I heard a couple of things that were said that sort of tweaked my interest. And I thought, well, wow, this is the place to be. Somebody said, if it hasn't been done, there must be a good reason for it. And I thought, well, boy, if that's true, there'd be a lot of great inventions that are never made. And then somebody said to me, oh, you know what? At a grocery store, I always choose the longest line to stand in. Well, I had just come from Lebanon, and the whole idea in the Middle East is you butt in front of the next guy. That's how you get ahead, you know.
Yeah,
so the idea that you would stand in the longest line sounded to me like this is crazy. So I figured, wow, if that's how people think in England, this place is going to be easy. So I just decided, you know what? I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to try my luck at rock and roll. And, you know, I kind of threw myself in, and I did things that I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do. And they worked.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one thing about America is that I think the average American tends to have a sort of positive, you know, attitude that, you know, think, you know, the glass is half full. where in England, I think they had just not so long ago had come out of World War II, where, you know, I think the propensity was to think the glass is half empty, mm-hmm. you know, because they'd just been through a horrendous situation. You know, in America, we never really had to face that.
Well, Greg referenced the bankruptcy, and there was that disastrous tour and not hugely successful experiences with Wishbone Ash and Renaissance and those bands in the first era. And then you wind up kind of in exactly the right place at the right time, open to anything in front of you in the punk era. But I was surprised, Miles, given how much, you know, Greg and I are of the age where, you know, some of the formative records that shaped our life you put out were IRS records, right? So many of those bands meant so much to us. I just got the impression, though, reading you recount the punk years, that you were always a little skeptical of punk. You were like, the key is not to be looking back, not to be part of the past, to be moving forward. But did you like that energy? That's what I was wondering.
The energy was actually great, and that's what I liked the most about it. Mm. I mean, some of the bands could hardly play.
Yeah.
I remember I one of the bands, it was Susie and the Banshees. They were playing somewhere, and I got a roadie to help them out. And he had been with the Climax Blues Band. So he knew, you know, he knew how to tune a guitar and plug an amp in and all that good stuff. And I said, look, just help this group out, you know, get them on stage. And I couldn't go to the show. And I get this phone call, and he goes, Mose, how am I supposed to help this group? They can't play. They can't play. He was sort of shocked that, you know, but that was the beauty of it. I mean, you could have guys that said, well, you know, I don't know how to play drums, but I'm going to be a drummer. And they grab a drum kit, they get on stage. And next thing you knew, they were in a band, mm-hmm. you know. So it was this fly by the seat of your pants, I'm just going to go do it attitude that was actually kind of anti-English at the time.
Yeah.
So the punks excited me with the energy and the fact that they kind of said, we can do it. Mm-hmm. We don't have to be heavily trained musicians, you know, and actually they said, we don't have to have a lot of money, which was perfect for me because I had none at the time.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, so I was penniless, but I knew the business. Nobody would pay attention to them. They did not know the business. So I was like the perfect guy they could work with because they would take my phone call, so to speak, you know,
mm-hmm.
whereas the regular music business wouldn't. People just wrote me off. So the punks and I were sort of in the same boat. We were both penniless and nobody would pay attention to us.
Right. When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose.
That's pretty much the way I saw it. But I was excited about the energy of it. But, you know, when I saw the Clash or the Pistols or whatever, I mean, I didn't walk away saying, man, that guy's a great guitar player. Or, wow, what a drummer. You know, you walked away saying I liked what they were doing or what they were saying, but it was not a musical experience, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Well, your brother Stewart's band, The Police, initially, Stewart wanted to be part of that wave of punk bands. He wanted to be a punk in that punk scene. I think you had a perspective on the band that maybe they didn't in choosing that single that broke them through, right?
Well, the reality was Stewart really pushed to have this group be a punk group because he got excited about all the energy just like I did. And Sting really didn't like the punk thing. You know, I mean, his view was the lyrics are crap. You know, nobody can play. He came from a jazz group.
Yeah.
But he also, you know, liked the excitement of the thing and the vibe of it and the press and all that. So I think he got excited about it, but not musically. Some of the songs that he was writing, Roxanne being one, he would not think would work within this whole punk thing. So when I said, let's record an album and went into the studio, they didn't want to play me Roxanne because they figured, well, it's, you know, it's everything punk rock is not. It's sweet. It's quiet. It's a ballad. It's a love song. And the punks were busy going, you know, rah, 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 it's gonna work, gotta this, screw you, hell with you. It was all aggressive and nasty. So Roxanne was the antithesis of that. So when I said to the group, you know, play me the damn song, I've come here all this way to Leatherhead, the engineer finally put it on. And I'm listening to this song and I'm thinking, that is true to what the Police really are. Mm-hmm. You know, it had this sort of reggae pop, it had all the elements of breaking the rules in a way, but in a way that was musical. And I looked at the band and said, guys, you've created a masterpiece. And they looked at me like I had two heads. You like that? So I think in that, in the back of Sting's head, he must have been thinking, hell, I got a lot more songs like that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well, and this is
and
when
of course,
punk,
Walking
know,
on the Moon and
yeah.
Can't Stand Losing You and all those other great songs he had, you know.
And punk,
so
punk becomes new wave, you know, Miles, because it has that attitude. Punk got rigid fairly quickly in what was punk. Got to be angry, like you were saying. And then it's like, well, yeah, but we can do other things. We can write like the Beatles, like Squeeze, a band that you loved dearly, or the Police, or, you know, we can do other things.
Well, the bands that finally came through were ones that actually had musical ability, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Buzzcocks, when you first listen to that record, it sounds kind of raucous. But when you listen to Pete Shelley's songs, you realize those are really good little pop songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And that's why they've been picked up on a lot of commercials. So you hear the Buzzcocks picked up on quite a few big corporate commercials.
I just want to love her like any other. What do I get? I only want to bend the stake to the end. What do I get?
Underneath all that sort of anger and aggression, there were real songs there. So the punk bands that really lasted, the ones that had something more than just anger, those ones lasted and became very influential. But what really happened is a lot of the musicians who got excited about it followed up with, you know, the New Romantics and all these other types of groups came forward. And all of a sudden, the music took the energy, but also added musical ability and the willingness to kind of break rules and to look at things anew. And you had this whole new music come out, which they've called New Wave,
right.
Which, by the way, I got blamed for creating. Somebody said Miles Copeland has created the word New Wave to hide from the fact that it's really all punk music.
Mm-hmm.
I did not invent the word new wave, but I'll accept it. You know.
The French cinephiles got there first, right? The point being, you mentioned the Buzzcocks, and I had a question for you about that, Miles, because I always thought the Buzzcocks, in retrospect, are deeply appreciated for the songs they wrote. They were a hugely melodic band. A lot of people still say to me, like, how was that band not on the radio constantly back then? You know, I have the same question. What was it? The Buzzcocks clearly had the talent, the songs, as you said. What kept them, you know, Police explodes, but the Buzzcocks don't. What's the difference?
When I first signed the Buzzcocks, you know, I had the rights for North America because they had a British company that did sign them. But nobody in America would pay attention to them because they only heard the kind of raucous, rough edges of the band. What I heard was the fact that they were actually pretty damn good, you know. And I liked the energy, but I also liked the song. So we put the record out and we sold something like 25,000 copies. But the reality was nobody really at A&M considered the group a real group. Now they do, of course, but you know, at the time people were, they understood the Police. They could understand that because they played more than three chords. But a lot of the bands they missed. As a matter of fact, when I went into Jerry Moss and I was getting pressure from a lot of the acts I had in England, so we want our record out in America. So I would, you know, I went to Jerry Moss and said, look, Jerry, I've got all these bands in England and I've recorded them and they want to see their records out in America. So I'll tell you, I'll make you a deal. I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. I don't need your money. Just release the records and I'll do the rest. Okay. Because I'd already recorded the groups, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the Buzzcocks, I made a cheap deal with them because nobody else would sign them. So, you know, they didn't have a lot of negotiating power. So when Jerry says, well, okay, we'll form a label. Okay, cool. That's all right. Oh, by the way, let me hear the music. And I said, ah, no, you can't hear the music. Because I knew if he'd listened to the music, he would have rejected it out of hand.
Yeah.
You know. So I said, look, that's the deal. I won't take your money. You won't ask to hear the music. And that's how IRS started.
When we come back, we continue our conversation with Miles Copeland. That's coming up on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back. This week we're talking with music executive and label co-founder of IRS Records, Miles Copeland. Let's hear more about what Miles had to say about the money aspect of the music industry and what it was like working with Sting.
You know, there's a sad undertone in parts of the book, Miles. Although you're a great raconteur and you have great stories and funny tales, often you write at one point, a label's only as hot as the acts it represents. One thing's for sure, IRS was great at signing great acts. I would agree. But all too often, they had some inbuilt self-destruct within them. We had more than our share of shooting stars. And it's true. You know, there's a big reassessment now of the Go-Go's career and the phenomenal success they have when you put out their debut album and the idea to pair them with Richard Goddard and they're crying. We had Kathy Valentine on the show. You know, they were crying. You know, they took all our rough edges away. It was like, yeah, they polished the melodies and you still had the energy and it was brilliant, right? But so many of those bands self-destruct. You tell the tale of the Bangles and the Go-Go's and Wall of Voodoo. And, you know, I'm wondering, perspective-wise, how much of it was that IRS was an indie haven, a place that fostered creativity, but was still part of this big, bad, rapidly becoming extinct, if not already dead today, music industry. A&M, and then later MCA, they didn't understand these bands, they didn't care, and the pressures were always mounting to make the bands different than what they were. Whether it was Susanna Hoffs, you gotta be solo, you don't need those others, right? Yeah, but that was the charm of the band, was that it was four people, right? Or the Go-Go's, Belinda Carlisle, you gotta do this, you gotta do that. Everybody was always still telling bands what to do.
We at IRS, you know, when we started, we were signing bands with very little money. We had nothing to lose. You jump 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years later, and we have offices to pay. You know, we have rent to pay. We have 60 staff to pay. And the other big thing that happened is the other labels woke up. So now when I went to a Go-Go's concert and no other A&R man was there to sign the group, I was the only one in the room. Now I would go see a group and there'd be 10 other people from other record companies who had a lot more money than I did. Mm-hmm. You know, and I used the example of REM. You know, they were the one group that stuck their guns and got all the way to the end of the contract. You know, they did 6 albums for us. They're the only band at IRS that went beyond 3 albums. But at the end, they said, well, you know, we'll go to the open market and see what we're worth, you know, and if you offer us the most money and the best deal, we'll side with you. We'd love to be with IRS. We offered and offered money, and money went up and up because now they were a big act and every label and their mother was offering money. And I went to Jerry Moss finally and said, look, it's more money than I have. Will you help me? And he said, I'll help you. And finally, it was down to A&M and Warner Brothers. And the group came to me and said, well, Miles, your offer is really good, but I think Warner's is going to beat you. And I said, well, go see exactly what they'll do and let's try to arrive at a conclusion here. So they came in later and they said, Miles, Warner Brothers said, whatever you pay, we'll double it.
Oh, God.
And I knew at that, there was no way.
Oh, wow.
You know, I couldn't cut a check for $10 million.
That,
you know?
That deal at the time was the biggest the music industry had seen. Yeah.
I actually looked at the group and I saw the letter from Warner Brothers. And I said, gentlemen, here's my advice. Get out of my office, go straight to Warner Brothers, sign this deal before they change their mind.
It's true.
And I was very proud of the group that they had actually reached, and they actually probably, I think it stands today as the best record deal ever made.
Yeah, no, and, it's legendary.
You know, IRS had a real hand in that, you know,
yeah.
And I have to be proud of that. Of course, we lost the group, and a lot of people got depressed in the label because, you know, we lost REM, but that's life. You know, we also had a lot of bands that were very, very successful, you know, and they didn't realize what they had until years later. And that, you know, the Go-Go's is a great example. I think the Bangles, you know, were a great example. They reformed. A lot of bands reform, you know, once they realize, you know, I tell the story of Dave Gilmour and Pink Floyd, who said to me, you know, one night I go to a Floyd show and he comes back to my house and we got to chatting and he told me this story of how the Pink Floyd reformed and he realized that they had really had something that it didn't matter what the musicianship was. It was just somehow there was a unique combination at work and that's really what counted.
Yeah.
And I think the Go-Go's discovered that, the Bangles discovered that, and a lot of bands that are reformed have discovered that.
Mm-hmm. They had something great and then didn't realize it. Well, you know, with REM, it's fascinating because they did have this longevity, which other bands, Jim had mentioned, all these bands that came and went, right? Despite the fact that they were clearly talented people. You know, outside looking in, how would you explain REM's longevity? What did they have that these other bands didn't? Besides, you know, obvious talent they had, but the other bands were talented too. What was it about REM that enabled them to sustain what they were doing over such a long haul?
Well, I would say they were crazy in a very good way. They were not pretentious. They just said, look, we'll do what we do and we'll get to the end of the contract and we'll fulfill it. Where a lot of bands succumb to pressures from their friends or from, you know, the lawyers or the accountants saying, let's go get some more money. Let's do this. You know, I think REM were just one of these bands that just said, well, we believe in what we're doing. Let's go do it. And they were very, very unique. I'll be honest. They were the only act at IRS Records that lasted the entire time. The Police, however, stayed with A&M because the lawyer I had at the time was Mr. Moneybags. You know, his quote was always, it's not about the money. It's about the money.
Right.
Take the money now. We'll worry about things later. So every time the band would have a success, he would say, hey, let's go make up the deal. The Police also were older than a lot of the punk bands were. You know, they were wiser. They could have the latitude to be sensible, really. Whereas a lot of bands, I think, they're always skating on the edge of disaster and success, you know, and a lot of them are very successful. I mean, people like Wall of Voodoo, you know, Stan Ridgway, I still think is one of the super talented guys, but he was one of those guys that had the ability to shoot himself in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
The Cramps, a band I loved, you know, people thought they were pretty crazy and wild, and they were. You know, they'd walk on stage and they would do crazy stuff. Off stage, they were really kind of nice people, but they were also weird.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was in this crappy hotel and one of the Cramps came to visit me. Next thing I know, I'm thrown out of the hotel because the Cramps came to visit me. And I begin to realize that why they look upon the world as everybody's against them, because you know what? A lot of people were.
Everybody. Well, you tell some great Steve Bader's stories, too. One of the very first interviews I ever did was with Lords of the New Church. I was in college at NYU, and they were playing at the Ritz in Manhattan. I love that band. You know, Steve had come from the Dead Boys, and it was kind of an idea that you had. Let's put this group together, Brian James of the Damned. I could never understand a word Brian James said. It was obvious he lost his order. I had no idea what he was saying. I said to Steve, can I take a picture while I'm here? And he jumped on top of the couch and pulled the painting off the hotel wall and gave it to me. So that's
Steve. Well, he used to do things. I mean,
Steve, I know you tell some
I remember him announcing on TV, well, it's anti-heroin week. And we thought, oh, that's good. So my advice take cocaine.
Yeah, right.
So got us kicked off British TV.
Oh, man.
You know, I was surprised one story that you didn't tell about REM, because Peter Buck told it for years in every interview he ever gave. I'm sure you heard this one too, Greg. You know, they said that a formative experience for them was seeing the Police open at Shea Stadium. They opened for the Police at Shea Stadium, right? I was at that show. I grew up in New York. And they saw that each of the Police arrive in different limos. And they said then and there that if we're going to survive in this business, we can't have that attitude. We have to be all for one, one for all. And famously, with Burtis Downs, their attorney, and Jefferson Holt, their road manager, they had a six-way split. You know, there was no star. There was no Sting, right, getting all the attention. We were going to divide things evenly. And it worked for a good long time until they blew up on Warner Brothers. So, yeah, Warner Brothers gave all that money, but then they didn't last as a great band much longer. But I was wondering if you'd ever heard that. Seeing what the Police became fairly rapidly convinced them they wanted to be, and here's a word, you know, that IRS paved the way for, an alternative.
Yeah, well, I think in the case of the Police, there was a recognition that everybody is contributing. So Sting did give up a share of his publishing to the other members of the band and to me as the manager, you know. So he recognized that, all right, he wrote the song, but the others made a contribution. So, all right, I'm going to give a percentage away, okay? So everybody got a taste, so to speak. Now, in the case of the Go-Go's, Charlotte Caffey wrote the biggest hits. And the Go-Go's never really, I guess they never really thought about it at the time. She kept all the publishing for her songs. She said, well, I wrote the songs and they're songs. Well, of course, by that first album, she made a lot more money than the drummer who wrote none of the songs.
Right.
So now there started to be pressure. Well, how come she's making twice as much money as I am? I'm in the same group. So publishing has been, you know, one of the bands break apart. This is a famous story of Simon and Garfunkel, you know. Yeah. It happened because Simon made all the publishing money and Garfunkel made nothing. So I think the REM were very smart to think, well, let's keep everything together by sharing it one for one and one for all. You know, the Police sort of did that, but they still recognized the fact that Sting was really much more than the other two were, songwriting-wise, and that he should get the lion's share. And he did. Mm-hmm. And that did sort of work. The Police did not break apart because Sting made more money than the other two. I think it really broke apart because Sting, if he chose the musicians himself, he could make the songs be exactly the way he wanted them to be. I think that was really sort of the motivation. It was more of it wasn't really about the money. Well, actually, none of the band were really. And that was one of the good things about them. And I think that was one of the good things about the Police, actually. But there are other bands that it really was about the money. Money was the main reasons the Go-Go's broke up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way they were splitting up the royalties. You worked with Sting even after he left the Police. You were managing him for quite a while. And I interviewed you, Miles, a long time ago when Desert Rose became a hit, in large measure because of something that you were able to engineer behind the scenes. But I thought it was kind of interesting that soon after, you and Sting actually broke up. That whole period of time where you sort of pioneered the idea of songs and TV commercials breaking hits, turning songs into hits because they were exposed on TV, and that opened up a whole new era. How did that, internally between you and Sting, how did that play out? It seemed like it had an impact on your relationship with him.
You know, one of the things about Sting was really great. He said to me, look, I want to know the truth. Never lie to me. The other thing he said is, be good to people on the way up because you may need them on your way down. So he always had a pretty good philosophy of life. But by the time, you know, Desert Rose was a hit and Brand New Day was out, there was so much pressure from other people nipping at his ear. And he'd moved to New York. I was living in L.A. My proximity was less. And I sort of say in the book, you know, that I think he was listening to people that were next to him all day, you know. And he finally just kind of threw his hands up in the air and said, well, you know what? I've kind of been there and done that. You know, it's like he's not one of these guys that climbs Mount Everest and then sits there for several days basking in the view, you know. He gets to the top and says, well, all right, I've done that. I think that's, in a way, how he thinks. You know, I don't know that that's true, but I sort of imagine that. And I think he did it with the police. He did it solo with me. He and I had a good run, and we all did very well. And, you know, I look back on it and think, well, good luck to you. And I have to be thankful for the experience that I had, and I'm sure he is as well. So
I would say, though, the general sense I get is that you were the one taking the chances in some ways, because you were the one that suggested, you know, the unconventional ballad as the single for the police, and then Walk Like an Egyptian, right, for the Bengals. Like, nobody thought that was going to be, the record company didn't, the big label bigwigs didn't think that was going to be a hit, but
well,
you
it was the same
did.
With Desert Rose.
Yeah,
the record
yeah.
company said it's not a single.
Right. Right.
So I, you know, it's funny that I look back at it now and I realize that the biggest songs of my career were the ones that everybody rejected.
Mm.
In the case of Roxanne, it was even the band rejected it. You know? Walk Like an Egyptian was such an obvious hit. But the record company said, no, it's not a single. We're not putting it out. It's too quirky. I mean, I listened to that song and I thought, well, that's a smash. Of course, you know, the Bengals were not particularly enamored with that song because there's no drumming in it. The drummer said, well, I don't like that song because I'm not on it.
Yeah.
You know, sort of like Stewart thinking about Every Breath You Take. I mean, it's hardly any drumming on it. So, mm-hmm. you know, he never really saw that song as a great song because he's not on it.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that struck me about what you were doing with the label is this notion of the label being a selling point at a certain point. Where people saw IRS and they go, I got to buy that record because it's on IRS.
Well, I always was thinking about merchandise and I was always thinking about image. And the name IRS was sort of a follow through from my father in the CIA because it kind of jolted. The minute you say CIA, an image comes to mind,
yeah.
you know, whether it be James Bond or some kind of wild shenanigans, who knows? An image definitely happens. There's a kind of a mystique to it. Same as the police. You know, if you're in trouble, you want to call the police. But if you're in a different kind of trouble, you don't want the police. So there's a double yeah. entendre.
Yeah.
So it was always this idea of the establishment, yet we were anti-establishment. I mean, what could be more establishment than the IRS?
Right.
You
oh,
know?
Yeah.
I have to admit that the IRS man image was not my idea. It was a guy named Carlos Grasso, who was one of the, I think he was the fourth employee he brought in to do the art. And he created this man. But the minute I saw it, I thought, that's what we need. And it's a great image now, you know. So it has this sort of mystique to it. And people still buy the T-shirt. Image is one of the very important aspects of rock and roll. Whether it be Kiss or Elvis Presley shaking his legs or the Beatles with long hair or the Police with three blonde guys, you know. Image is part of what helps sell the product.
Well, Miles, from your perspective today, we are down to three global conglomerates. You know, to even call them labels in the sense that IRS was is not even accurate, right? It's a completely different industry. And nobody is buying physical product. And thanks to the pandemic, you know, the one source of income for a musician was shut down for a good 18 months, right? The world's only opening up again now. What do you make of where the music industry, whatever is left of it, what it's become?
I would go back to what I just said. Now, I don't care how far back you go. The first job has always been, how do I get attention? How do I get noticed? Okay. So that job is still there today, but the platform may be different. Maybe it's TikTok today. Maybe it's Facebook. Maybe it's whatever, but it's still, how do I get noticed?
Mm-hmm.
And people say, you know, I mean, if you look at Donald Trump, how did that guy get to be president? Well, yeah. It's a great lesson in marketing. The more outrageous he was, the more press he got.
Yeah.
The same with the Sex Pistols and Malcolm McLaren. He realized that the more outrageous they are, the more press they're going to get. He didn't care that they couldn't play music or not. You know, he didn't care that they weren't great musicians. Matter of fact, he fired the one guy in the Sex Pistols who was actually a pretty good musician.
Yeah.
And he brings in Sid Vicious, you know. And I think that was that's a lot of bands have learned that lesson. I mean, it certainly helped Kiss. I mean, they make more money from merchandise than they ever did from ticket sales, you know. But I think with things like Spotify and some of the other avenues that are out there, it does expose people to, you know, listening to music they might not have ever heard before. I mean, they get exposed to music coming from Norway, from Finland, from strange places. I mean, my youngest son is 21. And the other day he was playing some act and I said, well, gee, what's that? What language is that? He says, well, I think it's Finnish. Hmm. Some group from Finland who would have got arrested 10 years ago, you know, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. Nobody would ever heard of, you know. And the fact that they're singing in a foreign language. When Desert Rose came out, I was told, well, that song can never be a hit because it's half of it's in a foreign language. It's got to be in English. And I said, well, why? What's your favorite song on the record? They all said Desert Rose. And I said, well, then it's a single. And they said, well, no, it's in a foreign language. They couldn't cross that bridge. Whereas Spotify has helped people cross that bridge. And I think it's kind of broadened people's perspective a bit.
We have been talking to Miles Copeland on the occasion of Two Steps Forward, One Step Back, his long-awaited memoir. We finally got one from Miles Copeland. Thank you, Miles, for being our guest on Sound Opinions.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, and you all take care.
That's it for our chat with Miles Copeland. You can find his book, Two Steps Forward, One Step Back, anywhere you buy books, hopefully at a mom-and-pop store. If you have any thoughts on this interview or the episode in general, leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, it's time to unearth some more buried treasures. We're going to dig up some records that we think you need to hear. And this week on our bonus podcast, Jim takes us on a trip to the desert island to play a song he cannot live without.
That's me. It's my desert island turn. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.